Hello, my name's Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to primary maths specialist Kieran Mackle, and you are in for a treat. Five quick announcements before we start. Yep, five. Number one, sponsor slots for the podcast are now open. If you want to let the world's most interesting listeners know about your book, product, or event, just drop me an email. Number two, just a reminder, you can view videos of all of Kieran's tips on the Tips for Teachers website. These are great to share in departmental meetings or training sessions. Number three, you can sign up to the all-new Tips for Teachers newsletter to receive a tip in your inbox every Monday morning to try out in lessons that week, plus a video to share with colleagues, plus a podcast to listen to on your way home, so do sign up for that. And number four, this is a big announcement. I've released the first of 10 premium Tips for Teachers online courses. This first one is on habits and routines, loads of practical suggestions that I've taken from my guests, reading research and my own experiences working with students and teachers all over the world. There is a link to the course in the show notes and many more courses to come soon. And last but certainly not least, if you find this podcast useful, please take a moment to review it on your podcast player of choice. It really does make a difference. Thank you so much. Okay, back to the show. Let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful Kieran Mackle. Spoiler alert, here are Kieran's five tips. Tip one, leave space between reading and implementation. Tip two, treat the act of teacher development like teaching. That's a big one, that one. Tip three, be explicit when modelling for colleagues. Tip four, some behaviours are more important than others. And tip five, nobody really knows what they're doing, least of all me. If you look at the episode description on your podcast player or visit the episode page on tipsforteachers.co.uk, you'll see I've timestamped each of these tips so you can jump straight to anyone you want to listen to first or re-listen. And this is very exciting, I nearly forgot this. I've splashed the cash here thanks to my wonderful Patreon supporters. And I've now got much better podcast transcripts where it's more of like a script and you can go to the different time and search words and all that kind of thing. So check that out for this episode and I'll be updating all previous ones with it as well. All right, enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Kieran Mackle to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, Kieran, how are you?
Hi, Craig. I'm all good. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. And for the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
So I've written the sentence down to make sure it was a sentence, but it's pushing the boundaries. So I'm a teacher, primary mathematics specialist, who for 5 years has led a collaboration of three schools as part of a project funded by the Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths, designed to raise aspirations and outcomes in an area of high socioeconomic deprivation. The author of two books on primary mathematics and host of the Thinking Deeply About Primary Education podcast. Hopefully that wasn't too long.
That's good. Plenty of commas in that sentence, but I'll give it you. That's very good. Right, well, I'll tell you what, Kieran, let's dive straight in. What's tip number one you've got for us?
So tip number one is to leave space between reading and implementation.
Ooh, tell us about this.
So I think it can be really exciting, you know, particularly when we're as interested in education and education research as we might be, and you know, our peers are, to read something and jump straight in. But I think that's possibly the easiest way to get towards lethal mutations, you know. So if I can give an example, the first time I read about retrieval practice was in 2014. So I read David Dowdow's What If Everything You Knew About School Was Wrong. And it was 2017 before I actually put anything in place that utilized it. I actually had to read David's book twice because it challenged quite a lot of my assumptions about education. But I went to the source materials, so I went to the Bjorks and some of their colleagues, you know, because they sort of co-authored work with different people. And then, you know, sort of poked for holes and then thought, well, how can we make this manageable in the classroom? And so I thought this would be, you know, I've read sufficiently enough that I can utilize this with colleagues. You know, one of the things I'm thinking about at the moment is the question about when does coaching become another fad? And I think it's when we don't spend time looking at the different models, because coaching, I think, is reasonably complex. And to read about coaching and then decide everyone in school is going to be a coach, I think that's not necessarily the most effective way to get the most from it. So I think, you know, look at what the experts say. There are different models of instructional coaching. You know, instructional coaching is perhaps just one model of coaching itself, and then you know, and then make a plan for maybe 6 months to a year's time and see where we go from there.
This is great. Let's dive into this. So first, just on the coaching thing, everybody's chatting coaching, aren't they, Kieran, these days? I need to get into this coaching. I need to get up that on the Twitter bio. I'm missing out here. It's all over the show. Where's that come from, do you reckon?
I mean, I think ResearchAid has been very, very effective in disseminating sort of messages about things that might have, you know, our best bets. You know, I was thinking about listening to Nick Rose on your podcast many, many years ago, and he was talking about what our best bets are. We don't know things are going to be effective, but we do know that some things are likely to be more effective than others. And I think when you've got people like Josh Goodrich, like John Hutchinson, talking about the impact the coaching might have and how they've utilized it in their context, I think, you know, combine that with Tom Sherrington and Ollie Oliver Caviglioli's walkthroughs, and you've almost got a critical mass of people who, you know, you should listen to when they speak, you know, saying this might be something worth doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the other thing I was going to say, so I'm really pleased when you sent these tips through. I love all of them, but this one in particular, because I've done this, Kieran, as well, right? You read one thing, you think this is the thing, and I'm going to dive in. And the problem was that I never read anything for 12 years. Then I tried to read everything. So my lessons were just a disaster beforehand. And like the year after I started reading stuff, because every time I read it, I just try it out and I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And I'll give you a good example of this. So interleaving is a really interesting one, mentioning the Bjorks. So when I first read it as part of Desirable Difficulties, I thought, oh, this sounds good. You just mix stuff up and something magical happens. But the kids hated it. Performance dipped, and performance dipped so much that learning never really seemed to take off in the end. And it was really bad. And I think it's only now, so this is what, maybe six years on from first reading about it, 7 years on, that I've finally started to get to grips with perhaps what it takes to make it work and some of the subtleties that I missed. So my first to say is I fully agree with you, but my follow-up question is, what helped me with interleaving wasn't just leaving time, but also making sure I checked out other people's take on it. I think this is quite important as well. There's a podcaster I listen to called Tyler Cowen. He talks a lot about this. He says, whenever you're reading about something, make sure you read several different people's take on it, because then you start to get the bigger picture of it. Whereas if you just focus on one take, even if it's really clear, you get a bit of a narrow view of it. So do you think it's a mixture of, when you read something, leaving time, but also then trying to get different takes on it in different sources, or is time sufficient?
I mean, I definitely agree. I think the best use of that time that you've left, you know, first time you read about something, okay, I've got a general idea. And then, you know, lots of people that I talk to will have three or four books on the go at the same time around similar ideas, and maybe not just education based, but how it applies and maybe in other contexts, you know, business, that kind of thing. So yeah, 100% with you. I think, you know, the best use of that 6 months is giving yourself the most rounded picture possible.
And final one on this, Kieran, it's tempting though, isn't it, right? Because you've read it, you want to try it. It's hard, and especially when you, because I've spoken about this with a few people, this kind of fear of missing out. You see on Twitter somebody's chatting about something, you want to dive in and give it a go, and you want to say, well, what's the worst that can happen? How do you resist?
That's a really good point. I think there probably is a fine balance between the practitioner in the classroom who might try something out, you know, tomorrow, and the school leader who is looking to plan for meaningful change. So perhaps the bulk of what I'm saying might apply more to leaders, you know, because in the classroom, you know, if it doesn't go well, you can always fix it the next day with something that's more tried and tested. I totally understand. I think it maybe depends on your particular context.
You're absolutely right there, because we've all seen this, right? SLT get hold of an idea. Next thing, it's the next big thing. It's the new policy. They haven't had time to think it through. The foundations aren't there, and it's a disaster. Yeah, I like that. So individual teachers, by all means, try stuff out. SLT, maybe just put a pause on it. That's good, thank you, and I like it. All right, what's tip number two, please?
So tip number two is to treat the act of teacher development like teaching.
Yeah, let's go for it.
So I'm talking specifically about the strategies that we employ when supporting others and improving, you know, the physical act, I think it is. And I, you know, the more I do it, the more I see the connection between how I would teach a class and how I would teach a teacher to teach. So, you know, I think if you very crudely broke the essence of teaching down, it might look something like explain, model, and practice. And I think I would use the same model when working with teachers in my schools. And, you know, I would explain something, I'd model it, and then they would be given a chance to practice, and we'd almost repeat that cycle. You know, I think some of the particular points that stand out to me are the idea that we remember what we pay attention to, and we'll come to this in a later tip. But I think when we ask teachers to pay attention to too much, you know, we're thinking about the EAF report, and Sam Sims talking about how we need to account for cognitive load when we're training our teachers. And he's probably talking about big inset days as much as he's talking about coaching with teachers. But if we're very specific, okay, I want you to pay attention to this, you know, you will attend to this one particular idea, then, you know, we're more likely to enact that in the classroom. And I think, you know, we expect our pupils to pay attention to the meaningful components of our lessons. I think Daisy Christodoulou's component parts, you know, making good progress. She talks about the goal state and word on your current state. And, you know, Michael Pershing pushed me on this a bit because he likes to talk about generalizations and broader behaviors. But I do think there is a place for breaking sort of bigger behaviors down into smaller parts, getting good at the smaller parts and then bringing them back together again. Just like the football players might do on a Saturday when they've been training different things all week, you know. So maybe the jury's still out, you know. I'd probably defer to Michael most times, but this is the way I've been sort of approaching teacher development in my current role. And then I think with explicit language instruction, you know, I want my pupils to know what the quotient is, I want them to know what the minuend and the subtend are, because they can use one word instead of seven or eight. And if we do the same and codify the act of teaching, then I think we have a better chance of sort of engaging on a more meaningful level. You know, and I know that people like Peps and stuff have talked about that for quite a while now, but it definitely has a massive impact when you're talking the same language.
This is dead interesting, this, Kieran. Right, let's dive into this a little bit more. Can you give us an example, perhaps, of either some training that you've led or some coaching that you've done where you've adopted this explain model practice approach?
I mean, typically I'll have a math-specific sort of input with all our teachers on the first Tuesday of a term. And so I'll say, okay, right, we're going to look at worked examples, for instance. Okay, here's what worked examples are. And then over the next 6 weeks, I'll go into classes. I'll teach people's classes. You know, this is how I interpret this. This is how I might do this. And then gradually, if I'm working with someone and they're an early career teacher, they might get more support than others. So it'll be me teaching 100% of the lesson at the start. And then by the time you get to 3 weeks later, responsibility is shifted to them. So we gradually fade, just like we would do with a sort of backwards faded example. Teacher takes more responsibility for that particular part until eventually at the end, I can sort of leave that plate spinning because they're more effective than I am at the whatever we've sort of explored.
This is really interesting, this. So I've been messing around with this myself. So first thing to say, I'll just put my cards on the table. Massive error I've made is the way I delivered CPD was nothing how I taught. And it was a disaster waiting to happen. So like I've said this before, I'm a real group work skeptic. I'm terrible at group work here. And Sammy Kempner, when he was on the show, he's changed my life thinking about group work, but I'm woeful at it. And yet CPD, how would things be set up? The tables would be in groups with the teachers. And again, whenever I attend CPD and I see tables sat in groups, I think, well, this is just a bit of a sit-off waiting to happen here. And it's just, I never fully engage with it. So now I really try and think of my CPD as how I would kind of teach lessons. Exactly as you say, what am I focusing the attention on here? How can I remove distractions and so on? So that was the first thing I wanted to say. And then just two concrete examples that I've used, and I just want either get your take or if there's anything you wanted to add to this. And mini whiteboards comes up every single Tips for Teachers conversation, and I'd say if it was a drinking game, people would be hammered on mini whiteboards here because it comes up all the time. But recently I've been doing quite a bit of CPD around mini whiteboards, and I've found the best way to get people on board is to show them how useful mini whiteboards are almost via by stealth. So you make it look like the CPD is on something else, like, you know, planning for depth or whatever it may be, but you use the mini whiteboard to facilitate paired discussion or to facilitate checking for understanding. And then at the end, you can say, okay, look, we've been using this tool. How could we then apply it to our lesson? So I think that works quite well, almost when you almost use the medium that you want to kind of train staff on, but you use it in a slightly different context to show the power. I don't know if that makes sense at all.
No, it does make total sense. And I think, you know, when you're delivering CPD, utilizing your sort of teaching strategies from the classroom, I think can really help. You know, because if you, for instance, did some CPD on perhaps, I don't know, cognitive load theory, and you looked at, you know, the combination, you know, very crude example of images and sort of key vocabulary, well, then you might use that in the rest of your CPD so that you're showing teachers, you know, this is stuff we do all the time, you know, or the use of multiple choice questions. You know, I'll quite often put a multiple choice question from, you know, spacing things out, something from the first session, something from the last session, you know, and then when we come to the session on memory, people are going, oh, okay, you know, I get it, and then they feel it. Yeah, so I totally agree with you.
Let me just ask you one final one on this, Kieran, because I've been looking forward to asking somebody this, and you're my man for this. So what I try and do whenever I kind of coach teachers or work, do CPD and so on, is to try and do two things. Make them feel like the student so they can experience what it's going to be like for their learners. And then, so I get them doing like the maths and the activities and so on. And then I say, okay, right, now we're going to jump out of that. And now let's put our teacher hat on and think kind of pedagogically what we need to change to make this work and so on. But the difficulty I have, and even this is at secondary level, so this is why I'm interested what it's like at primary level, is it's quite hard to make the teachers feel like students because of, like, the examples we invariably use are pretty straightforward ones. So like in maths, let's say I'm doing something on learner generated examples or whatever it may be. I'll say, okay, think of two fractions that add together to make one or whatever it is. Teachers just whiz it down straight away. Whereas obviously the students, they're going to take a bit more time. Maybe they're going to want to ask somebody and so on. So I find it hard to fully replicate how the students will act in the thing that I'm doing the CPD on. But that feels like a real problem with the CPD, because I need teachers to appreciate that so they can then empathize with their learners and so on. So that was a bit of a ramble. Do you know what I mean there? And have you experienced this? Because I imagine at primary level, this is an even bigger issue.
I think it's potentially easier when you know the teachers you're working with. So I've been working with our guys for 5 years, and I will always use examples that are just beyond where they're working mathematically. So you'll find questions with triangular numbers and the solution being,
nice,
you know,
yes.
Or if you think about Anne Watson and the paper on taxicab geometry, they managed to make those teachers, even though they were specialists, you know, believe that they were working in Euclidean geometry, but actually they were working in non-Euclidean geometry.
Yes.
So almost, you know, that was like a watershed. Almost, okay, right, so this is just beyond. Yeah, so I do think it's easier when you work with the teachers every day and you know what their mathematics is.
That's interesting. So let's take your worked example thing. If you're doing worked example training and you wanted the teachers to experience what the worked example's like, you wouldn't do a worked example from kind of year two mathematics. You may in fact do a worked example from a higher level of math so that the teachers feel like the novices that the kids would be. Would that be right, Kieran?
At the point that I want them to feel that sensation. Obviously, I will illuminate and illustrate with examples that are phase specific. But when I want them to have the sensation of the learner, then I would choose something that's maybe key stage three, bridging to key stage four.
That's brilliant, right. I'm going to have to brush up on my further maths and start whipping some of that out for the secondary colleagues. That's brilliant. Love it. Right, Kieran, what is tip number three, please?
So I think tip number three ties in. It's be explicit when modelling for colleagues.
Yeah, let's dive into this then.
So like I said, I think this comes from reading Alan and Sim's Teacher Gap, where they talk about small, actionable teaching assignments and the idea that some schools improve their teachers better than others, and it's usually through specificity. You know, so when colleagues are watching me teach, I'll ask them to focus on one thing, and vice versa, when I'm watching them, it won't be your old school, this lesson was a good or an outstanding lesson. It'd be, okay, how did the worked examples go? And was there sufficient difference between the consecutive examples, and being really, really specific in what exactly it was. And I actually saw the benefit of this the other day because one of our early career teachers, we'd been working specifically on routines and behaviors. And as I was going for, I was taking some people around the school, and we were, happened to be in her class. She was using many whiteboards, and they had a signal for when they were ready to continue. She had a system for checking in different parts of the class at different times, and then she was ready to move in. And I was all, this is, she's executing this better than I could ever have imagined. But that's because we spent 3 weeks only looking at that part of her practice, because she's going to be a teacher for 30 years. There has to be something that she learns in year two, learns in year three. So I find that really helpful. I think one caveat is that safeguarding is an exception. If there's something to do with that, then that needs to be addressed at the right time. But what I took from reading Alan and Sims, and then there's an American book called, oh, I can't remember, the name escapes me right now, but it's basically an exploration of business and education. Learning to Improve is the name. And they take examples from business that might apply to education. And they said something very similar. When the feedback you give and the criteria is more specific, you're more likely to enact change. And so that's something we've been doing for a while. And I think again, it's what you do with the pupils, but let's do it with the teachers as well.
This is Greg here, and right, a couple of follow-ups on this. So the first thing is the teacher gap. That's a brilliant book, isn't it? Hey, I don't think that gets the attention it deserves. That's one of the best ones I've ever read. It's and again, Becky Allen and Sam are absolutely brilliant. But I'll tell you one thing, she's not returning my emails at the moment, Becky Allen. So she's in my bad books. I'm trying to get her on here again, but so I've gone off her a little bit. But I will say that that book is absolutely excellent. It's a brilliant. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But I'm really interested in this, Kieran. This. Firstly, I love that point that let's just focus on one thing. So you're going to be teaching for 30 years. There's no rush. That ties in with a lot of things that have been said on Tips for Teachers about not trying to accelerate your career too much. Just taking your time, focusing on one thing, getting better at that, and then moving on. I love that. But I'm really interested in the practicalities of this. So, let's imagine you're working with an early careers teacher. Firstly, who decides the focus? Is that, did you suggest things? Do they suggest things? Is it, how does the focus come about?
I mean, I think it's changed since the early career framework was brought into place. I mean, this is the end of the first academic year, but there's a real roadmap for generic sort of pedagogy that we can follow. Obviously, my support is often math specific, but I think that there's a lot of crossover. And so, before the framework, I would use my knowledge of my practice and what I thought was effective teaching. And we'd codify what we thought effective teaching looked like. And so it's almost a combination of both now, where there will be some math specific things that I focus on, but a lot of things will work just as well with the new framework.
Got it. And if you're, let's say you're working with a specific teacher and you've agreed on a focus, whatever it may be, let's say it's worked examples or whatever, what would the conversation before the lesson where you watch them look like? Would you be saying, look, I'm literally just going to be focusing on this one thing, so don't worry about anything else? What does that conversation be? Because the reason I'm asking you this, Kieran, is often there isn't a conversation before a kind of supporting observation like this, and it feels to me like that conversation is quite important.
It is, and it was probably more important for me at the start because I needed to establish that I wasn't in my schools as another stick to beat the teachers with, because they've been
Yes.
through, the only constant was change for quite a while. But I've removed myself from the accountability process. My notes are my notes because my working memory is limited, and I need to remember this conversation at 6 p.m. because I might be working with a teacher at 9, 10, and 11, and then planning with someone in the afternoon. So I think it's very important that you establish that this is, getting better, not because we need to, but because we have to, or not because we can. And I think the more experienced a teacher is, the more freedom I think they have to decide where they're coming from. But generally, I think the things I introduce will be just beyond normal practice enough that they'll think, oh, I'd quite like to get better at that thing we talked about at your staff meeting.
Got it. And just the final one on this, and it's the obvious question. What does the conversation afterwards look like? Is it, I mean, do you start it with the classic, how do you think that went, or what do those conversations play out like?
It depends on if I've done the teaching or not. So I'll ask them, what did you notice if I was the teacher? And I probably will start with, you know, how did you think that went? Or, but again, being really specific to, you know, how did that worked example work? You know, what did you notice about the pupils' responses? Because I think, you know, it's very easy for us to give value judgments on ourselves. Oh, it was terrible. They weren't listening, you know, that kind of thing. But actually, that's not important. Were the questions similar enough that we could draw generalizations, you know? So I think normally very informal, because, you know, we're doing very important work, but we can almost build this relationship where it's supportive, you know, because we want everybody to be the best teacher so the pupils get the best education we can possibly have.
Just a final point on this. So Chris Such, who I know, obviously you know very well, was on the show a few episodes ago, and he talked a lot about depressurizing learning. And one of his strategies was that as a teacher, he'd make a mistake fairly early on when he meets a class, just to show that everybody's human. It doesn't matter if you make a mistake and so on. It almost feels like that, you know, kind of depressurizing this coaching or this observation feels like an important thing. Would you ever, I'm not saying that, I mean, I do this without even knowing, but would you ever deliberately do something suboptimally for two reasons? Just so, one, you've got something to talk about, and two, it kind of takes you off your pedestal and the teacher realizes that everybody's human, or does that not feel like a good idea?
I mean, I haven't done it on purpose, but when I do make a mistake, because no lesson's ever going to be perfect, I will own it and I'll say, well, that wasn't ideal. What can we do to improve that next time? You know, because, you know, what have we got? We've got a 3 form, a 2 form, and a 1 form. There are lots and lots of teachers. So I will have these conversations openly in the staff room about where I've gone wrong. You know, so I think, you know, maybe in the future I will plant mistakes. But you don't have to look very far to see mistakes that are getting made in the lesson anyway.
Can I ask you just one bonus on this, Kieran? Apologies for keep digging into this, but I'm just fascinated. I can see this model working really well in your school, where obviously you know the staff, you probably know most of the kids, and you can do this. I'll teach this lesson, you teach the next, maybe we'll do it together and so on. Let's just say you were kind of transported into another school where perhaps you're an external consultant or whatever you are. Would you still do the kind of I'll teach? Do you think that's still the best way to start this process for them to watch the strategies you're talking about in action? Or is the fact that you're not familiar with the school, the pupils, is that too much of a barrier?
I mean, it's always tough. You know, the strength of teaching comes from knowing your pupils, doesn't it? But I think that we want to almost disarm anyone who we're looking to support, you know. Yeah. Oh, he's going to put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, it's very easy for people to come in and say, do this, and do this. They'll be back in 2 weeks to check up on you. I think I got a lot of currency from my teachers, and I think I would in other schools if I sort of was the one who led, because then I think people who are reticent get a bit of breathing space and think, okay, this isn't so bad.
Yeah, I think that's really important. That's brilliant. All right, Kieran, tip number 4, please.
So, I don't know if this has got consensus, but some behaviours are more important than others.
I like this, because, again, you know I love a clickbait headline. This is a good one. This is bringing in the numbers that we need, Kieran. Right, tell us about this.
So, I don't think hierarchy is a perfect metaphor, but I think it's a workable metaphor, and that gives us the space to think about how we teach. You know, so you've had lots of people talking about behavior, and so, for instance, in any hierarchy, behavior would be the first thing that you need to get right in your classroom before you can do anything else. You know, can make everything else possible, because the routines we have, the expectations of learning, then allow you to focus on your pedagogy. So, you know, at the start of Thinking Deeply About Primary Mathematics, I said, read Tom Bennett's work before you even start this book, you know, because it's going to save you. You know, I learned that the hard way, and I think probably most teachers do, don't they? And then I would have explanation and instruction, because I think if you get good at those and you can explain things, then you build some space from your senior leadership team, because when they're popping around the class, they'll see, oh, there's what they would call good teaching going on. And, you know, we know it's only part of the picture, but I think if we can establish that with some modelling, perhaps as a bare minimum, then you know you could teach kids, and I think they could make progress. And once you've got those in place, then you start thinking about things like variation, like task design, and maybe strategy selection. You know, because that's the nuts and bolts of the thinking we need to do in our PPA time. You know, so we're planning, we're thinking about the question selection, we're thinking about, well, do I want to have a background of sort of a variant background, or is it invariance? You know, I don't think you can think about that if you haven't cracked the fundamentals. And so I would almost have, you know, there are many, many more things that go into what it means to be a teacher. But I would say that general hierarchy gives you the most rapid and sustained progress, because it gives you space, but it also establishes a minimum competency very, very, very early on.
Got it. Just give us the hierarchy one more time, Kieran.
So behavior, explanation, instruction, and modeling, and then your things like variation, task design, strategy selection. But in that group, I'm having everything that we, you know, like if we're reading about education and we're thinking about confidence weighted multiple choice questions, they're not the first thing you explore, but they're definitely very powerful once you've got the hang of the basic role.
Right, this is brilliant. So the first thing to say is obviously when I first started teaching, I did the exact opposite. So all my thoughts was on the tasks, and I wasn't even good at that. It was just like poor task selection, and that's all I was focusing on. I'm really interested. I completely agree with you. I'm going to ask you the worst question in the world, Kieran, and I know the answer is going to be it depends. But how long does it take to kind of move, I guess, down the hierarchy? Like how long will it typically take to get your behaviour to the point where then you can start thinking about your explanations and modelling?
I mean, you would hope that within the first 6 weeks, you know, you're right, it does depend, and teachers will take it to it more naturally. But I think where a school has really good systems in place, and it's just a matter of adopting those systems, that's much more manageable than having to establish them against the tide. You know, but I would hope that by October, November, we could start thinking about pedagogy, because, you know, the class we're learning as, you know, as default.
So this is the obvious follow-up question, and I apologise, it sounds really kind of aggressive, this one, I don't mean it to. What's happening in those 6 weeks in terms of learning then, if the kind of focus of the teacher is on behaviour? Is it just a case of, you know, the explanations and task design will be suboptimal, but that's just the way it's got to be?
I mean, my preference is for the utilisation of high-quality textbooks. So you're almost guaranteeing a minimum standard of instruction, even if you just follow the script. You know, I'm not saying that's the best way to use high quality textbooks, but it's on a fundamental level possible. Where that's absent, having really high quality curricula, you know, things like the REACH curricula in history and geography and science, you know, they go a long way to supporting teachers in their delivery. And then the more competent and confident you become, then you can experiment with those really interesting bits of pedagogy, you know. I accept that those aren't in place in all schools, particularly not in primary schools, but that's what I would recommend, you know. And I think even if those aren't in place, if the behavior isn't sorted, the learning is going to be suboptimal anyway. So I don't necessarily think there's a comparison to be made.
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense. I've spoken about this perhaps on the Mr. Bart Maths podcast, that if you'd have asked me, you know, any time in the first 12 years of my career, is it a good idea to have kind of centrally planned lessons or, you know, prescribed approaches? I would have said definitely not. Like, the whole point of being a teacher, you want to be creative, freedom, express yourself and all that. But I look back now and think I was talking nonsense, because, as you say, if you're starting out teaching, and even if you're an experienced teacher in a new school, if you don't have that behaviour right, it's going to be an absolute disaster. And it's such a weight off your mind if somebody says, look, just use this example. We thought this through. This is probably a good example to use. And I'll tell you what, once you've explained it, give them this task, because this is probably a good task to use. And as you say, that'll get them through, won't it? You know, most of those kind of 6 weeks or so. And then you can then start to look at the next bit, as opposed to either looking at things the wrong way around or trying to just sort everything out all at once. It just doesn't work. So the more I think about it, prescription, particularly early on, it's probably a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I tell people this all the time, but I had her when I started teaching, and within 18 months it was gone. And I think it was the inspection criteria, you know, because it was six activities for every single lesson, you know, throughout the day. So, you know, there's only so long your follicles can put up with it.
That's good. Hey, let me ask you just this thing now, Kieran, just in case I forget to ask you this. So obviously we've done four tips here, and in this one in particular just highlights how much thought needs to go into to being a maths teacher. You've got to get behavior right, then you've got to think about explanations, modeling, and then you start thinking about all the nuances, task design, variation. But the thing is, primary teachers, they've got to do this for all subjects. How the hell do there is not enough money in the world to pay me to be a primary teacher. How do they do it, Kieran? Something's got to give, hasn't it?
I think where schools have really sensible approaches to workload, you can prioritize thinking and learning. You know, I've got a colleague, Lloyd Williams-Jones, been on the podcast quite a lot. He will give his teachers whole days at the start of term to brush up on their subject knowledge. You know, and I think where that kind of situation exists and people are allowed to explore, say they're teaching the Vikings and Scandinavian history in that sort of, you know, 1st century, wouldn't it? Then spending 6 hours getting to grips with it, you know, I think goes a long way. And I think when I think about school development, I'm thinking about, well, in 5 years' time, if we have a body of teachers who are sufficiently knowledgeable about, you know, both the subject knowledge and the pedagogical content knowledge of a broader range of subjects, then I think we're moving in the right direction. You know, I do think that too much is asked. You know, I think the curriculum is too broad. My preference would be for a specialist model, but I do know that that's, again, not a consensus view. Schools have just got to do the best they can to provide their teachers with time to think. So if they're not doing unnecessary paperwork, then you can spend time thinking. And if you're not doing, you know, other bureaucratic chores, you know, staff meetings that could have been emails, then you have more time in your day. So it's about how you use, you know, the ideal being 45 hours in a week. How do you use those 45 hours? Well, I'm going to use a substantial amount of teaching, but the rest I want to focus on what's important rather than things that are there because they've always been there.
Two quick follow-ups on this. I'm fascinated by primary schools, Kieran. How is maths the subject that gets the biggest focus in terms of kind of CPD, pedagogy, and so on? I'd imagine English should be at a similar level. But what about the other subjects? Like, is there enough time to think deeply about geography and art and all that kind of stuff?
I think at the minute the expectation is that there is. You know, schools would maybe have on an inset day, we'll do some focus on art. But the new inspection framework has sort of almost guided schools towards a model where they do have to spend more time thinking about sort of subjects that would have been neglected before 2018. You know, because I remember when I first started teaching, it really was reading, writing and mathematics that we had to get right because that was what the school would be judged on essentially. And the rest, well, it was okay. You know, I mean, I was lucky that I had a teacher who valued lots of those subjects and so provided us with additional opportunities, but I think it's becoming the norm. I don't think we've got it right at primary in terms of how we use our staff meeting time. And there are definitely people like Matt Swain who are talking about how we might use it in a different way. You know, maybe breaking one long meeting into two smaller meetings and having a focus over 5 or 6 weeks rather than a different focus every week. But yeah, I think the jury's still out on that one. And we'll see where we are in maybe 4 or 5 years' time once we've been through a full cycle.
Last question on this, Kieran. I'm always fascinated by how much of maths pedagogy transfers to other subjects. So anytime a school asks me to come in and do a whole kind of staff training session, I always say, look, I don't have a clue what I'm doing outside of my nice little secondary maths bubble. But then I know some of my books are read by teachers outside of maths and they can find the strategies apply and so on. How do you find that at primary? So let's take, for example, you were saying about worked examples. Would that transfer across? Would teachers be able to use what they do, worked examples in maths, in history, in English, and so on? Are there aspects of maths that transfer quite nicely across?
I think so. I think particularly those that have been researched by cognitive psychologists. And it might be easier for maths teachers or teaching maths, because a lot of the examples are quite often mathematics based. But, you know, for instance, something like retrieval practice will work equally effectively across the curriculum. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've tried as a country in mathematics is to establish the idea that all pupils can attain well if they're given the right support. And so we use manipulatives quite often. We used multiple examples. We use sort of scaffolds. But there's no reason why we can't do that in history, you know, and scaffold and really, you know, thinking carefully about the information we present to pupils. And so then that will almost alleviate some of the cognitive burden on those pupils. So I think it does take a lot more thought, and perhaps because the broader conversation has fewer examples from the other subjects. But if you look at the principles, you know, like I was talking about general behaviours, you look at those general principles and think, how might this look? Well, there's nothing to lose from trying those out, I don't think.
Fantastic. Right, Kieran, what is your fifth and final tip, please?
Nobody really knows what they're doing.
I like it. Don't tell me about this.
Okay, so it's really hard to do this one without offending anybody, and that is definitely isn't my attention or my intention. And I'm the worst for accepting this is true, but I will defer far too much to people with experience and expertise, to the point where sometimes if I meet them socially, I will struggle because of how much I don't want to sort of make myself sound silly in front of them. You know, interviewing Peps was really difficult because it's so much respect for his intellect. I'm thinking, right, okay, I'm going to have to cut everything I said in this this episode. but really, it's a mental health or mental space tip. I think we should always strive to be better. We should learn from people who are more experienced, but I don't think we should beat ourselves up that we aren't other people or that we seem to be making mistakes that other people don't make. You know, I always talk about how, you know, the universe is, what, maybe 14 billion years old, and a bad lesson hasn't ended it yet. So, you know, maybe it's not going to be career ending if we make a mistake, you know. But like I said, I will spend hours when I'm supposed to be sleeping worrying about things that happen at work. So I need to take this advice myself. We acknowledge that everybody's just muddling along the same, you know, regardless of their position in sort of the system, you know. And the default attribute of most teachers is that they want to help other people. So ask them for help and give yourself a break from time to time.
It's a really, really important one that, Kieran. Well, when I started the Tips for Teachers thing, I really wanted, obviously, the pedagogical advice, but also this kind of stuff. And Jamie Tom did a similar thing about turning down the negativity radio, he describes it as, where you know, you teach four decent lessons, but one crap lesson, and that's the crap one's the only one that you think about. When I did my Mr. Bart Maths podcast, my favourite question to ask was, what's your favourite failure? Because then people like Dylan William and Peps would say, look, I messed up by doing this. And it's quite refreshing to hear as a teacher trying your best that, you know, the so-called greats also struggle. And you're absolutely right. Everybody struggles from time to time. The only thing I just wanted to say about this is Twitter's an interesting one for this, Kieran, because it can be, like, I would say it's my single best source of ideas, where I see people kind of sharing things and I think, wow, that is really, really good. But it can also make you feel bad in a couple of ways. Firstly, there are some idiots on there who just, you know, take everything out of context and try and upset you. But also, it's this fear of missing out thing we spoke about before, where you're seeing people who are doing things and you think, I'm not doing good enough for that. Like, there's a secondary school teacher, Helen Constantine, who designed some of the best questions I've ever seen in my life. And I think, I'm nowhere near that level. Like, my kids are dipping out because I'm not doing that. So Twitter's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you kind of want to be on there to get the ideas, but very rarely do I leave it feeling like a better person or a better teacher. You know, it's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a pretty healthy block mute process. Because I don't think people go on Twitter to, you know, when they speak on Twitter, it's not necessarily to engage in meaningful dialogue, and the form restricts it. So really what you want to do is you want to embrace the echo chamber, you know, and okay, here are some people who I really respect. I'm going to see what they have to say. You know, and if people are out to be bad faith actors, well then I have no interest. So I'm going to block or I'm going to mute, you know, maybe not in that order. But yeah, it's difficult because I think across the spectrum, you know, Adam Buxton does a podcast, and I think at the start of his, he used to make fun of Twitter all the time. You know, oh, it's a place for reasonable discussion and stuff. And, you know, he's absolutely right. And if they're having similar issues, you know, then there's not much hope for us. But I think in terms of switching off, I will physically switch my phone off because it's very hard to resist. And I remember Doug Lamov either tweeted about it or he wrote it in one of his books about the experiment where the only way your attention wasn't going towards your phone was when it was switched off and in a different room. Even if it was switched off in the same room, you were still, you know, yes. Students were still looking at it or whoever the study was. So yeah, so I tried smartphone free, like Bruno Reddy, for a while, but I was missing too many important phone calls because the signal wasn't good enough. So it turned off in a different room and we go from there. But yeah, it's far from a perfect model.
That's very good. And last question on this, Kieran. Let's imagine you've had a bad day, lessons haven't gone well and so on. How are you dealing with that? How are you kind of stopping yourself? Because I'm terrible at it. I lie awake, as you mentioned before, thinking about it. What works for you to switch you off it?
So, I mean, I started the Think Daily podcast during lockdown when there was a lot more free time. And if that was going to continue, then I needed to be more specific about when I was going to do it and what would constitute an acceptable amount of time in my evening. So we've actually carved out, there's one night a week, that's when recording happens. And then we've got a selection of activities that my wife and I will do when the kids have gone to bed. And so we'll think, okay, do you want to do the puzzle? Do you want to do the paint by numbers? And, you know, that for us at the moment works, you know. And I think weekends are becoming busier because we're allowed outside and things. But yeah, because I was definitely at risk at one point of spending far too much time editing podcasts that didn't need to be edited anymore. Yeah, I'm sure you can relate.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Well, they've been five absolutely brilliant tips, Kieran. I absolutely love that. So let me hand over to you. What should listeners check out?
I mean, I don't think my friends would forgive me if I didn't say that at Saturdays at 9 o'clock, you can check out the Thinking Deeply About Primary Education podcast. You know, because I think, I'm very lucky that very interesting people will talk to me about education. And so, well worth checking out.
You know, just on that, Kim, so I'm a big fan. Just if listeners, because you've got a massive back catalogue now, right? So maybe pick out one or two episodes. If listeners were to start with something, where would you advise sending them?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll go for a maths and a literacy one. So obviously Christopher Such, he's done maybe 6 hours on reading, but his first episode in, I think it was season two, episode six, he spends 2 hours talking about reading. And essentially, it was just before The Art and Science was published and got a chance to really pick his brain because I didn't know half the stuff that he was talking about. And then Matt Swain talks about mastery and how he's made it work at the primary level with the Step Academy Trust. So I think those two seem to interest people, but also I think they go pretty deep. But to be honest, we've done 80 episodes, maybe 81 by the time this goes out, and you know, all the guests are fantastic. You know, I think we're blessed with the deep thinkers we've got.
Fantastic. And anything else? What about your book?
I'm hopeless at publishing my own stuff or promoting my own stuff. I've got Thinking Deeply About Primary Mathematics, which links quite well into this sort of these tips because it's based on my work. And okay, I'm seeing general patterns here, I'll write it down. And so I see it as a blueprint for teachers who are inexperienced or would like to improve their professional development. And hopefully it's both accessible and sort of challenging at the same time. And that's from John Kett. And actually we shared an editor. I think the editor of your second book, Craig, was the editor of that one. So I knew I was in good hands when I sent it off.
Oh, that's fantastic. Superb stuff. Well, I'll put links to all those in the show notes. And all that remains me to say, Kieran, is this has been an absolute pleasure. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
That's been lovely. Thank you very much.